Well, thank you for having me this evening. And before the event, we tried to work out between Ali and myself a useful division of labor. And I'll try to go through the documentary record on the Israel-Palestine conflict and then allow Ali to discuss the current events, the current political scene. One of the things that's often said about the Israel-Palestine conflict, it's almost become a cliche or a commonplace, is that it's so complicated, it's so intricate, it's hard to take a side because it's more complex than particle physics, than rocket science. And yet, if you look at the actual documentary record on the past, the present, the future, which basically means the historical record, the human rights record, and the legal diplomatic record. If you look at the actual record in the conflict, what's remarkable is how little controversy there actually is on the Israel-Palestine conflict. Now, what I'm going to try to do this evening in the time that's allotted me is to go through this record at a fairly rapid clip, but trying at least to go through the key points, the salient points in the record, to try to illustrate what I think is the case, that this is a remarkably uncomplicated conflict, and the possibilities for resolution of the conflict are not nearly as complex as is sometimes believed. So let's begin with the past, the historical record. This is mostly a younger audience. There are a few older people in the room. I won't make eye contact with them because they'll feel that age bearing down on them. It's very painful for people from the 60s to have to bear with the fact that now they are in their 60s. So I'll refrain, as I said, from the obvious suspects. But for those who remember, discussion of the conflict maybe 30 or so years ago, the most vehement topic on the Israel-Palestine conflict was always, how did those Palestinians become refugees in 1948? The origin of the Palestinian refugee question. And there was a standard, what you would call official Israeli interpretation, which was the one that most of us learned in school, which we read in fairly mainstream books, and which was pretty much even accepted in the scholarly community. And it went something like this. Most of you are familiar with it. In 1948, as Israel was about to be born as a state, the neighboring Arab armies stood poised on the borders of the newly formed state of Israel, about to invade it, and they transmitted these radio messages to the Palestinians to flee from the conflict zone, to leave their homes, and that after the Arab armies had thrown the Jews into the sea, the Arabs of Palestine would then be able to return to their homes. That used to be called sort of the Arab radio broadcast's interpretation of how the Palestinians became refugees. How many of you who are a little bit older in the room remember that explanation of the refugee question? Raise your hand, I'm just curious. Yeah, as you could see, that was what was fairly standard. But you could say now, beginning in the late 1980s, new research was done on the topic, and the research now, you could say there's a broad consensus on what used to be the most contentious issue on the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict. You could say now there's a broad consensus among historians that actually what happened, to use the leading historian, Benny Morris, to use his terminology, what happened in 1948 was an ethnic cleansing. And that's become pretty much the consensus in the scholarly community, There are some differences of opinion. For example, there's the difference of opinion about whether or not the ethnic cleansing was premeditated, intentional, or whether it was simply a product of war. Benny Morris, for example, says that it wasn't an intentional ethnic cleansing, it was the result of a conflict. Wars breed refugees. But to show you how narrow the consensus now is on the subject, or how narrow the spectrum is, you can take the case of the former Israeli foreign minister, Shlomo Ben-Ami, who by training is a historian on the Spanish Civil War, but a very good historian for sure. And a few years ago, he published a book called Scars of War, Wounds of Peace. And he says in the book, well, the record is fairly clear. What happened in 1948 was an ethnic cleansing. But he says, I disagree with Benny Morris on how it happened. He says, judging by the record, it's clear that what happened was intentional. It was premeditated. To use his words, it was anchored in the Zionist philosophy of transfer. Transfer back then being the euphemism for expulsion. So here you have a case of an Israeli foreign minister. He was the foreign minister in 2000 under Ehud Barak. An Israeli foreign minister who takes the most extreme position on what happened in 1948, saying not only was it an ethnic cleansing, but it was clearly intentional, premeditated, anchored in the Zionist philosophy of transfer. Apart from the refugee question, the other contentious issue in the history of the Israel-Palestine conflict is, of course, the issue of war and peace. Who bears responsibility for that relentless series of wars and conflicts between Israel and its Arab neighbors and between Israel and the indigenous population of Palestine? Obviously, it's impossible, given the time allotment, to go through the whole history of all of those wars, the major ones being 48, 56, 67, 68 to 70, what's called the War of Attrition, 73, 82, and so forth. It's impossible to go through the entire record, but what I can do is summarize the findings of one of the leading scholars in the field. His name is Ze'ev Ma'oz. He was the former director of the Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University, and he wrote a very excellent book called Defending the Holy Land. And the book is a hefty volume. It's about 800 pages. And with all due credit to him, he's an excellent scholar. Most of the book is given over to synthesis. He takes all of the latest scholarship over, say, the last 15 years, synthesizes it to present a picture of what happened in the realm of war and peace over the last 60 years since Israel's founding. And it's worthwhile just to listen to his conclusions, bearing in mind, as I said, these are not the idiosyncratic, the eccentric conclusions of some far-left historian. This is a very mainstream scholar synthesizing the findings of mainstream scholarship on the topic. On the subject of war, he says the following: Israel's war experience is a story of folly, recklessness, and self-made traps. None of Israel's wars with a possible exception of the 1948 War of Independence, none of Israel's wars was what Israel refers to as a war of necessity. They were all wars of choice or folly. That's the record on war. How does he synthesize the record on peace? Israel likes to say that the Arabs never missed an opportunity to miss an opportunity for peace, and Israel's forever in search of a partner for peace. But here's how he summarizes the scholarly record. Israel's decision makers were as reluctant and risk averse when it came to making peace as they were daring and trigger happy when it came to making war. The official Israeli decision makers typically did not initiate peace overtures. Most of the peace initiatives in the Arab-Israeli conflict came either from the Arab world, the international community, or grassroots and informal channels. When Israel was willing to make risks for peace, these usually paid off. The Arabs generally showed a remarkable tendency for compliance with their treaty obligations. In quite a few cases, it was Israel, rather than the Arabs, that violated formal and informal agreements. That, as I said, is the scholarly synthesis on the key, the salient elements of the historical record: the origin of the refugee question, the origins of war, and the obstacles to peace. Let me now turn not to the past, but to the present, the human rights record. Normally at this point, I would go through a fairly complex history of the human rights record, but I decided for this afternoon or this evening to focus rather on the specific question of what happened in Gaza. Trying again to look at the official documentary record on what happened. Israel officially justified the Gaza massacre on the grounds of what are called self-defense against Hamas rocket attacks. That justification is self-evidently not tenable. If Israel wanted to avert Hamas rocket attacks, it would not have broken the ceasefire with Hamas that triggered the rocket attacks. And Israel also had the opportunity to renew the ceasefire with Hamas as late as the last week in December, but chose not to. More broadly, Israel has had the option for at least three decades of ending the conflict with the Palestinians, including with Hamas, and terminating armed hostilities altogether. I won't have time now, and perhaps Ali will, to go into those specific points. Let me look at the human rights record just before the Gaza massacre. And here we have a fairly extensive documentary record. We can start with the record assembled by B'Tselem, the main Israeli human rights organization monitoring the human rights record in the occupied territories. The Israeli Information Center for Human Rights in the Occupied Territories. A couple of weeks ago, it released its annual report on the situation in the West Bank and Gaza for the year 2008. And it leaves off just before the Gaza massacre. It goes from January 1st to December 26th. And these are its findings. Between January 1st and December 26th, Israeli security forces killed 455 Palestinians, of whom at least 175 were non-combatants. Palestinian armed groups killed 42 Israelis, of whom 31 were civilians. So, on the eve of what Israel called its war of self-defense, the ratio of Palestinians to Israelis killed was 15 to 1, 15 Palestinians for each Israeli in the year 2008. If we limit ourselves strictly to civilians for the year 2008 up to December 26th, the ratio is at minimum 9 Palestinians killed for each Israeli killed. If we turn strictly to Gaza for 2008, 158 Gazan civilians were killed at minimum. 7 Israelis were killed due to Hamas rocket fire. And so the ratio of civilians killed, looking strictly at the Gaza so-called theater, the ratio is 20 Gazan civilians killed for each Israeli killed. Israel, as we all know, loudly protested and protests till today the detention by Hamas of one Israeli soldier, Corporal Shalit. In fact, we all know him by name. Well, Israel has, in the year 2008, detained not one Israeli, but between 8,000 and 11,000 Palestinians are being held by Israel. Of those, roughly 10,000 being held by Israel, according to B'Tselem, 550 are administrative detainees. That means they're being held without charges, without trial. Of those 550, 42 have been held now for more than 2 years without charges or trial. Beyond that, B'Tselem reports that Israel tightened its sweeping restrictions on the freedom of movement of Palestinian residents in the West Bank, quoting B'Tselem, expanded illegal Jewish settlements, the illegal Jewish settler population is now up to 500,000. It confiscated more West Bank land, again quoting B'Tselem, causing serious harm to Palestinians who are no longer able to work their land and gain a livelihood from it. It continued, again in the words of B'Tselem, to prevent any possibility of development and construction in Palestinian communities. It continued to discriminate in the distribution of water. The Palestinian population of the West Bank is 9 times the size of the illegal Jewish settler population, but the 9 times greater Palestinian population has a total water allocation which is smaller than the illegal Jewish settler population. And Israel continues to build the wall in the West Bank, which will steal approximately 12% of West Bank land in violation of the advisory opinion of the highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice, which said the wall was illegal and had to be dismantled. Let me now look at the specific sequence of events that led up to what happened in Gaza. In January 2006, Hamas was elected into office in what were then called the freest and fairest elections ever held in the Arab world. Maybe not the highest standard, sort of like the tallest building in Plains, Georgia, but nonetheless, the freest and fairest elections ever held. Israel reacted to the elections by tightening its economic blockade of Gaza. In 2007, Hamas preempted a coup attempt orchestrated by the United States, Israel, and elements of the Palestinian Authority. Israel then tightened its blockade of Gaza. In June 2008, Israel and Hamas entered into a ceasefire. The terms were fairly straightforward. Hamas would cease its rocket attacks on Israel. Israel would substantially lift the blockade of Gaza. Hamas, in fact, according to the Israeli official website, and now I'm quoting it, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Hamas was careful to maintain the ceasefire. It did so despite the fact that Israel reneged on its critical obligation to substantially lift the suffocating blockade of Gaza. The official Ministry of Foreign Affairs website continues, "The ceasefire was sporadically violated by rocket and mortar shell fire carried out by rogue terrorist organizations. But Hamas tried to reinforce the terms of the arrangement on the other terrorist organizations and to prevent them from violating it. Hamas, careful to maintain the ceasefire. Israel, refusing to lift the suffocating blockade of Gaza." During this period, the former High Commissioner for Human Rights, Mary Robinson, she goes to Gaza and she says, "Gaza's whole civilization has been destroyed. I'm not exaggerating," says the former High Commissioner for Human Rights. Hamas continues to maintain the ceasefire. On November 4th, when the attention of all the media in the United States is riveted on the outcome of the US election, Israel breaks the ceasefire. It goes into Gaza and kills 6 or 7 Palestinian militants. Hamas retaliates by firing rockets into Israel. Incidentally, the Israeli Ministry of Foreign Affairs, it uses the expression in retaliation for what Israel did. Then Israel tightens the blockade of Gaza yet more. The Harvard economist Sarah Roy, the world's leading authority on the Gazan economy, she writes, "Food, medicine, fuel, parts for water and sanitation systems, fertilizer, plastic sheeting, phones, paper, glue, shoes, even 2 teacups are no longer getting through in sufficient quantities or at all. The breakdown of an entire society is happening in front of us, but there is little international response beyond UN warnings, which are ignored." At this point, Hamas offers to renew the ceasefire if Israel will lift the asphyxiating blockade of Gaza. Israel says no. It demands a unilateral and unconditional Hamas ceasefire. In effect, whatever Hamas did, Israel would continue to suffocate the people of Gaza. And for them, it became a choice to starve or to fight. And they chose to fight, even though the fighting was, on their side, largely symbolic. If you look at the record, the actual documentary record, it seems fairly clear that the Palestinians had a much stronger case than Israel for resorting to armed force in self-defense at the end of December 2008. What happened in Gaza between December 27th and January 18th? The facts are pretty clear, not very controversial. They go something like this. The Israeli Air Force flew 3,000 bombing missions into Gaza. They call them sorties. When I studied French, that used to mean a date. I don't know why the military adopted that term. I'm sure there's a good explanation. 3,000 sorties into Gaza. All the planes came back. None were downed. None were even damaged. Not very surprising, because the Gazans had no anti-aircraft defenses to speak of. That was the air war. The ground war, Israel goes into Gaza. There are no major clashes, no major battles. Hamas basically fled the field, the zones of conflict, and whatever fighting occurred, it occurred at night. Israel was geared with high technology, night technology. They waited till the nights to fight. The Hamas, the few fighters that remained behind, were unable to defend themselves. As one Israeli strategic and analyst put it, he said, "It is very dangerous." This is after what happened. "It is very dangerous for the Israeli army to believe it won the war when there was no war. In reality, not a single battle was fought during the 22 days of fighting. This is not a war. It is not even a real battle. So what was it? Israel went in from the sky. It was like shooting fish in a barrel. It went in on the ground when Hamas was unable to resist. So it's not surprising what the final tally was. 1,400 Palestinians killed, about 960 civilians, between 300 and 400 children. Total Israelis killed, 13, of whom 10 were combatants, 3 civilians. The proportion, 100-1. 100-1 is obviously not a war. If we understand by war, two sides shooting at each other. 100-1 is, as any dictionary would tell you, it's not a war, it's a bloodbath. It's a massacre. It's a slaughter. But we should have no misapprehension that, as the strategic analyst writing in Haaretz put it, this is plainly not a war. It's not even a battle. It is a massacre. After the massacre, the most authoritative study to date, human rights study, actually, there aren't that many to date, because Israel has blocked Human Rights Watch and B'Tselem from sending its human rights observers into Gaza to see what happened. As the Human Rights Watch head for the Middle East, Sarah Lee Whitson, put it in a recent statement, "What does Israel have to hide that it won't let human rights investigators in after the conflict is over. Amnesty International found, and now I'm quoting it, Israeli forces killed more than 1,300 Palestinians in Gaza, more than 300 children, many other civilians, injured 5,000, including many civilians. Israeli forces destroyed thousands of homes and other property and caused significant damage to the infrastructure. Some of Israeli bombardments and other attacks were directed at civilians or civilian buildings. Others were disproportionate and indiscriminate. Amnesty International found what it calls, quote, indisputable evidence that Israel used white phosphorus as well as artillery fire in, quote, densely populated residential areas in Gaza. And on the Hamas side, it found, quote, indiscriminate rockets in the residential areas of southern Israel killing 3 civilians. Amnesty went on, the direct an attack on the civilians and civilian objects, disproportionate attacks, indiscriminate attacks, those are all war crimes. And then it says explicitly, unequivocally, it says, quote, Israel's use of white phosphorus in densely populated civilian areas constitutes a form of indiscriminate attack and amounts to a war crime. Amnesty then did something unusual. It looked very carefully at who made that massacre happen. How did it happen? Who made it possible? And it pointed nearly all its fingers at the United States. In very lucid language, it says, the USA, the main arms provider for Israel. The USA providing arms for Israel despite the fact that it violates US legislation. And then, if there is any doubt, it says, Israel's military intervention in the Gaza Strip has been, and even I was quite surprised by this, has been equipped to a large extent by US-supplied weapons, US-supplied munitions, US-supplied equipment, paid for with US taxpayers' money. And it goes on, and quite importantly, very importantly, for the first time in the history of human rights organizations, the leading human rights organization in the world calls for a comprehensive arms embargo on all parties to the conflict in the Israel-Palestine conflict. That's the human rights record. And finally, how do you solve the conflict? How do you resolve it? We're all supposed to throw our hands in despair, shake our heads. It's so complicated. It's so intricate. How do you resolve it? It goes back to biblical enmities, clashes of civilization, clashes of religion. How do you solve it? In fact, the solution has been staring us in the face for the past 3 decades. It's not controversial at all. It's anchored in the most elementary, the most basic tenets of international law. Uncontroversial tenets of international law. Now you may say I'm engaging in hyperbole. I'm engaging in exaggeration. How can it possibly not be complicated? That sounds absurd on its face. So let's quickly go through the record. Everyone in this room will, of course, agree the most representative political body in the world is the United Nations General Assembly, the most representative political body in the world. Every year, the UN General Assembly votes on a resolution. It's called Peaceful Settlement of the Question of Palestine. And every year, basically the resolution is the same. It puts forth the foundational principles for resolving the conflict. Number one, Israel has to fully withdraw from the territories it acquired in June 1967. That means the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza, and the whole of East Jerusalem, because of that fundamental principle in international law that it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. Number two, the Palestinians have to have the right of return and compensation under that fundamental principle of international law, going back to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's the formula they put forth. What's the vote? Is the vote close? Is it controversial? Is it up for grabs? Let's look at the vote. Because of time limitations, I'll look at the last 10 years. 1997, 155-2. Who are the two? Israel and the United States. 1998, the vote, 154-2. Israel and the United States. 1999, the vote, 149-3. Israel, the United States, and the Marshall Islands. 2000, 149-2. Israel and the United States. 2002, 160-4. Israel, the U.S., the Marshall Islands, and now another one of those South Pacific powerhouses, Micronesia. 2003, it's getting bigger. Israel, the United States, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, Palau, and Uganda. 2004, 161-7, and so forth to this past year, 161-7. The whole world on one side, the United States and Israel, and a few South Sea atolls, the combined populations of which can fill the empty seats in this room, on the other side. You can go back 20 years from now, 1989, October 1989, same vote, excuse me, same resolution, the vote, 151-3. The whole world in the United States, Israel, the whole world on one side, and the other side, Israel, the United States, and the island state of Dominica. Well, some of you in this room are skeptical. You're thinking to yourself, hey, but that's the United Nations. We all know the United Nations is prejudiced against Israel. It's partisan against Israel. We know they're all anti-Semites except for Palau, Nauru, Tuvalu, Micronesia, and the Marshall Islands. So let's put aside the United Nations for argument's sake. Let's look at the most respected political body in the world. Let's look aside, put aside the most representative, and let's look at the most respected, the highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice. In July 2004, the International Court renders a landmark advisory opinion on the wall that Israel has been building in the occupied territories. I mentioned earlier that the International Court ruled the wall was illegal. But before it ruled the wall was illegal, it voted on all the critical basic issues on the Israel-Palestine conflict except one. On the issue of borders, it said Israel had no title to the West Bank, no title to Gaza. These are, to use the language of the highest judicial body in the world, the whole of the West Bank, the whole of Gaza are occupied Palestinian territories. On the question of East Jerusalem, the highest judicial body in the world votes East Jerusalem, occupied Palestinian territory. On the question of the settlements, it rules the settlements are all illegal under international law, Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. That was the advisory opinion. What was the vote? Was it close? The vote was 14 to 1. 14 of the 15 judges agree on all those points. One dissent, the American judge, Thomas Bergenthal. But even the American judge, he begins his statement by saying, in fact, I agree with a lot of what the majority says. And then on the crucial question, namely the question of the settlements, because if the settlements are illegal, the game is over. Israel is obviously not keeping the occupied territories for their scenic value. What does the one dissenting judge say? He says, I have to agree with the majority. To quote him, he says, paragraph 6 of Article 49 of the Geneva, excuse me for one moment. Paragraph 6 of Article 49, I'll find it in a half second, of the Fourth Geneva Convention does not admit for exception on grounds of military or security exigencies. It provides that the occupying power should not deport or transfer parts of its own population in the territory it occupies. I agree that this provision applies to the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and that their existence violates Article 49, paragraph 6. What does that mean? In a nutshell, it means this. Most of you who are familiar with the lingo of this thing called the peace process, they always refer to what they call the final status questions, the ones which are alleged to be so complex, so intricate, that they have to be put off to the last stage of negotiations. What are those final status questions? Borders, settlements, Jerusalem, and refugees. Borders, settlements, Jerusalem, the highest judicial body in the world says they're not complex at all. Israel has no title to the West Bank, no title to Gaza, not one square inch of it. On the question of Jerusalem, the highest judicial body in the world says not complicated at all. It's occupied Palestinian territory, just like the whole of Gaza, just like the whole of the West Bank, because it was acquired in the same way. It was acquired in the course of a war, and under international law, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. That only leaves the refugee question. The court didn't rule on it because it wasn't relevant to the question of the wall. But the main human rights organizations in the world have made a statement. Everybody in this room knows the main human rights organizations in the world are Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. Both of them, both in 2000 and 2001, issued statements in the question of the refugees, position papers. Amnesty was very clear on what it said. Let's see if I have it here. Yes. Amnesty International says it calls the Palestinians who fled or were expelled from Israel, the West Bank, or Gaza, along with those of their descendants who have maintained genuine links with the area, to be able to exercise their right of return. Human Rights Watch, it says, we urge Israel to recognize the right to return for those Palestinians and their descendants who fled from the territory that is now within the state of Israel and who have maintained appropriate links with that territory. You'll notice the language is almost identical. Is that because one is plagiarizing the other? One is cribbing the other? No. The reason is quite straightforward. It's the same reason why there were no dissenting judges except one in the International Court of Justice. It's the same reason why in the United Nations General Assembly, apart from some South Sea islands, there are no dissents. Because these are simply uncontroversial, uncomplicated questions of international law. These are tenets of international law. The inadmissibility of acquiring territory by war, the right of refugees to return to their homes. The record is quite clear. It shows that apart from the United States and Israel, There's a consensus on how to resolve the conflict. It's not only a global consensus, it's a regional consensus. In 2002, the main regional body, the Arab League, put forth a peace proposal. And the peace proposal was exactly the same as what I've mentioned already, a two-state settlement and a just resolution of the refugee question based on the right of return and compensation. But the Arab League went one step further. It said, Israel, just obey international law. Just accept what the highest judicial body in the world says. Just accept what the highest political body in the world says. And we'll not only terminate hostilities, but we'll go one step further. We'll initiate normal relations, that is to say, trade, tourism, and so forth. Periodically since 2002, the Arab League has been renewing that proposal to end the conflict in accordance with international law and the consensus of the international community. And finally, Hamas, it begins to join the consensus. Beginning in 2005, Hamas says too, we'll settle on the conflict in the June 1967 border. I can quote many statements. Let me just quote one exactly a year ago today by Khalid Meshal, the head of Hamas's Politburo. He said in March 2008 that most Palestinian forces, including Hamas, accept a state on the 1967 borders. And that really is, in a nutshell, not only the context for the current conflict, but it's a nutshell expression or explanation of why Israel attacked Gaza on December 27th. It had nothing to do with the Hamas rocket attacks, because if it didn't want those Hamas rocket attacks, it wouldn't have broken the ceasefire which triggered them. The problem was, as one Israeli political scientist put it many years ago, he said it's those periodic Palestinian, and this is his expression, peace offenses. Now that's a real problem for Israel, because Israel likes to pretend there's nobody to negotiate a settlement with. And so long as there's no one to negotiate a settlement with, it can get on with the business of appropriating, annexing, and stealing the West Bank. But every once in a while, those Arabs, those Palestinians, they start to act in a diabolical fashion. They start saying, we want to resolve the conflict. We want to end the conflict. We want to reach a settlement finally. And Israel has a problem, those peace offenses. And the only way to resolve the conflict is to knock out your opponent, because your opponent is too moderate, your opponent is too reasonable. Hopefully you can either destroy it or radicalize it, and then you can get on with the business of what's Israel's main business, keeping the West Bank. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Finkelstein.